Previously on Beta.
So I says to him, you know, where's that old walk on the water spirit?
They'll see and they'll know and they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
To be a pop star, to be a rock and roll star or a country star, it's nice and it's great.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, comedy writer Bess Kalb tells us how she was able to capture the distinctive voice of her beloved Grandma Bobby in her book, Nobody Will Tell You This But Me.
She and I spoke so frequently during her life that I felt like I had almost downloaded her into me. I had the 10,000 hours of conversations that I could sort of auto-generate her at a moment's notice.
Also, we explore the life and music of Midwestern singer-songwriter Jason Molina with his biographer, Aaron Osmond.
He is really part of the canon of great American songwriters, in my opinion. He belongs in there with Townes Van Zandt and with Neil Young and Dylan and, you know, all the greats.
But first, we here at Beta hope that you're staying safe and well, and we hope that we can give your brain a bit of a break from the anxiety we've all been feeling. They say that laughter is the best medicine, and who are we to argue? So let's kick things off with Alan Zweibel. Alan started his comedy career selling jokes for $7 each to the last of the Borscht Belt comedians. He went on to become one of the original writers of Saturday Night Live, where he helped to create iconic sketches like John Belushi's Samurai Deli and Gilda Radner's Roseanne, Rosanna, Dana. Later, he joined forces with Gary Shandling to create the most deconstructive sitcom ever, It's Gary Shandling Show. Alan's memoir of his 40-year comedy career is called Laugh Lines, My Life Helping Funny People Be Funnier. We caught up with Alan in his home in New York City via Zoom, so excuse a few of the digital glitches and pops as he recalls a lifetime career in comedy and shares the special reason his stand-up career never took off.
4 months into it, Lorne Michaels saw me, wanted to see a bunch of my jokes, and I typed up what I thought were my best jokes. There were 1,100 of them, and I had my meeting with him because he wanted to talk to me about this new show that would be called Saturday Night Live that would premiere in the fall. So there were two clubs in New York at the time. One was called The Improvisation, and that's where Robert Klein and David Brenner, my friend Larry David, you know, they were coming through those clubs. And the other one was called Catch a Rising Star, and they had the same cast of stand-up comics. Billy Crystal was there more often than he was at The Improv, and that's where he and I met. And so I thought it was our turn, the baby boomer generation, to have our say. Because when you think about what SNL was in those beginning years, it was the baby boomer generation talking about what our lives were like, what our political point of view was, what our social mores were. So it was sort of a perfect fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned that you met my fellow Canadian, Lorne Michaels, while you were doing, during that four-month period when you were doing stand-up. Tell me about that initial meeting with him.
I typed up 1,100 of my jokes, and he was staying at, if memory serves, at the Plaza Hotel in the city, and I gave him this tome of 1,100 jokes, and he opened it, and he read the first joke, and he just sort of nodded and went, very good. And then he closed. But Lorne was incredibly smart. He kept the book. He asked me to tell him a little bit more about myself. And I got a phone call about 2 or 3 days later that I had gotten a job on this brand new show that would, like I said, premiere in the fall.
What was your proudest accomplishment on Saturday
Night
Live?
There were a number of them. I wrote The Samurais for John Belushi. John auditioned for the show with that character. Another writer named Tom Schiller wrote the first Samurai, which was called Samurai Hotel, and it was a hit. And then Lorne, a couple of shows later, Buck Henry was to come in and host. And Lorne said to me, you worked in a delicatessen before you got here, right? I said, yeah. He said, can you write Samurai Deli? And I went, oh, you bet. And then he walked away. And I'm going, all right, how am I going to do this?
Would it be
Would it be too much to ask if you could cut it in half? That's absolutely beautiful. Thank you very much. That's terrific. One other thing.
What about?
Do you think you could break a 20?
That was a signature that I had there. And a character that I co-created with Gilda called Roseanne, Rosanna, Dana. Gilda and I just made each other laugh. A writer named Rosie Schuster had written a sketch called Hire the Incompetent. It was a public service announcement where people who got fired from their jobs because of their incompetence, this was to say, please hire these people, even though they're incompetent. And for Gilda's vignette, she put on a wig and she had a dialect. And she was scratching her arms and picking her nose and all of that. It did well. And I had dinner with Gilda a few weeks later. And I was now running the Weekend Update section of the show. And I said, remember that sketch you did? I said, why don't we take that character and move her into Update, give her a name, and let her do consumer reports. And she would get a letter every week from a letter writer named Richard Fader from Fort Lee, New Jersey. I would write a letter to her in his name. That's my brother-in-law.
Mr. Richard Fader from Fort Lee, New Jersey writes in and says, Dear Roseanne, Rosanna Dana, last Thursday I quit smoking. Now I'm depressed, I gained weight, my face broke out, I'm nauseous, I'm constipated, my feet swelled, my gums are bleeding, my sinuses are clogged, I got heartburn, I'm cranky, and I have gas. What should I do? Mr. Fader, you sound like a real attractive guy. You belong in New Jersey.
It became in and of itself something that was ours and mine and Gilda's, I mean. And even after we left the show, we wrote a book that, as if it was written by Roseanne, Rosanna, Dana. So, you know, it's a lot of highlights, but those pop out right away.
Yeah. So you left Saturday Night Live after five seasons, and then you were doing some freelance work. And then a few years after this, you meet Gary Shandling. And one day, Gary, you do some work for him for an HBO special, I believe it was, or Showtime.
But it was actually a Showtime special.
Right.
Not
yes, yes, that's right. But anyway, I was going to say, Alan, one day Gary tells you about this idea for a TV show that he has. What did he say?
Well, we both had the same managers, and my manager called me up and asked me if I knew Gary was. I had seen him on Letterman, thought he was funny. It was like lightning struck a second time. As it had done with Gilda, it was somebody I could write with where we got each other. We could make each other laugh, but our senses of humor were just a little different to make the alchemy something that neither of us could have done alone. After the special was over, during that time, he told me about an idea that he had for a show where he would play himself, Gary Shandling, the comedian who would talk to camera. And I said, boy, that's weird. I said, because I had been thinking of a show. I was now married with two children. The husband would be, the father would be a comedy writer who could also talk to camera, as if Dick Van Dyke, the old Dick Van Dyke show, could talk to camera. So they were very similar.
Yeah.
We blended the two ideas together, and we came up with It's Gary Shandling Show. And it was the first cable show ever nominated for an Emmy Award, because prior to that, cable shows were not eligible for Emmy Awards. We had something called the Cable Ace Awards. Yeah, we had a lot of fun doing the show and broke some rules, and that's what Gary and I did together.
Yeah, you broke a lot of rules. I think that's what makes the show hold up so well, and why it's so funny and why it was so influential. It reminds me of that famous Picasso quote, every act of creation begins with an act of destruction. And you were destroying all these sitcom tropes.
Well, that's a wonderful application of that quote. I thank you. And that's what we did. Gary knew the sitcom form a little better than I did because he had written.
Mm-hmm.
I had never written a situation. I had a ill-fated pilot that I had written that was produced and didn't go anywhere. But I was a fan. I grew up on The Honeymooners and the Dick Van Dyke Show and whatever. But Gary and I, when we would write this show, we would say, okay, Three's Company would do it this way. They would dissolve from this scene to that scene. Well, what I had Gary do was we went theatrical. We had him control the narrative of his life. So we took George Burns, we took Jack Benny. He would look at the camera every so often with an aside. So we knew what our roots were, but we blew it up a little bit.
For those of you who've had your head in the sand for the last 2,000 years or have cable, you probably don't know about Mahjong. Mahjong has been around since the Ming Dynasty, where the imperial clan actually played for many, many hours right in the emperor's palace.
Flower.
Flower? Hey, to your flower, I say one white dot. I wish my red dragon could have seen that.
I was surprised to learn about the origin story of the theme song for It's Gary Shandling Show. Can you tell me about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, that's a perfect example of Gary and I being in total sync. We had left our manager's office, and we're going to the elevator now. This is in L.A. And he says, you know, we're going to need a theme song. And I said, okay, I get it. Anything you have in mind? He said, well, in the spirit of everything else, should we have a theme song about the theme song?
This is the theme to Gary Show. The theme to Gary Show. Gary called.
And then I looked at him and said, I'm almost halfway finished. How do you like so far? Like the theme to Gary Show. Now we get on the elevator and we're going down. And then Gary goes, this is the theme to Gary Show, the opening theme to Gary Show. This is the music that you hear when you watch the credit. And then I looked at him and I went, I'm almost to the part where I start to whistle. And the elevator gets to the lobby, doors open. Gary looks at me, I look at him, we go, all right, that's the theme.
The theme to Gary Shandling Show.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, that you guys are just so copacetic. That's like a great example of that, as you said. You adapted your novel, North, into a screenplay for a movie directed by your friend Rob Reiner. It came, well, you knew I was going to ask this, Alan. Come on. It came out in 1994, and Roger Ebert wrote a pretty scathing review of it. What did he say?
Oh, scathing?
Yeah. Is that an understatement? Probably,
I have the review in the other room in my wallet. I carry it with me. But, you know, look, I had written this novella, a very thin book, about a boy named North, 9 years old, didn't feel appreciated by his parents, declared himself a free agent, went all over the world offering his services as a son to the highest bidding sets of moms and dads. And the book did okay. It didn't break any records, but I had sent Rob Reiner the galleys because I wanted a blurb for the book cover. Robert hosted the third Saturday Night Live ever, and we stayed friends. And he called me up and he says, I really like this book. Let's do a movie. Well, I moved the family to LA, and I, you know, it's a writer's dream to write a book and you adapt it into a screenplay. And it became this $45 million movie. Jason Alexander, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Bruce Willis. And I fly my parents out from Florida, and there's a big premiere and greatest night of a writer's life, you know. And then the next morning, the reviews come out. Roger Ebert, I don't have the review in front of me, but I could tell you that there was one paragraph which went like this. I hated this movie. Hated this movie.
Hated every simpering, stupid, vacant, audience-insulting moment of it. Unquote, and so on. Altogether, I used the word hated 10 times. I have to give North credit for one thing, though. When I was preparing for this show, I didn't have to spend a lot of time trying to figure out which was the year's worst movie, so it saved me time.
I really let it get the best of me. I was, I gave him too much power at the time and let it depress me. It let me rethink what I was doing. My wife would come back from the supermarket and you know, LA's a company town, so other housewives would heckle her.
Oh, dear. That's not nice.
It was a little embarrassing, yeah.
Well, that's not nice. So did you ever run into Roger Ebert after his
review? I always wondered what it would be like. 10 years passed. I had written a book, a novel called The Other Shulman, which was very successful for me. It won the Thurber Prize, and I went all over the country on a book tour. And one stop took me to Chicago, and I was taken out to a restaurant. And now I'm looking at him, and he's wearing a sweater, which was four sizes too big for him. And it had all the autumn colors and burnt orange and browns and puke green. It was, all right. Now, he gets up and he starts walking towards the men's room. And as if I was on automatic pilot, because I had no idea what I would do. It was like I wonder what Alan's going to do to Roger Ebert. I excused myself from the table I was at. I followed him into the men's room. Now we're both in the men's room and we're washing our hands, and there's that mirror that's on the other side of the sink, you know, on the wall. I look into the mirror and I go, Roger. And he looks up and I see he's trying to place me. And I go, Alan Zweibel. And the blood drains from his face. And I said, Roger, I just have to tell you that I hate that sweater you're wearing. And he smiled, I smiled, he started laughing, I started laughing, we shook hands. And that's what happened when I ran into him. And I'm glad I did.
Yeah, and that was the perfect comeback. You came up with the perfect comeback.
Well, yeah, well, thank God for that sweater. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You've accomplished so much in your comedy career. You helped create two of the most iconic TV series of all time. You've written novels, short stories, screenplays. You won the Thurber Prize for one of your novels. Your work has appeared on Broadway. Is there something that you haven't done yet that you're still itching to do?
A brochure. I've never written a pamphlet. You know, Billy Crystal and I just completed a movie that we co-wrote called Here Today. Billy directed it, and it stars he and Tiffany Haddish. And I'm 70 now. Billy's a couple of years older than me. And I would say to him more than once, look how old we are, and we're still doing this. And we get off on it. Look what we love to do, and we're still being allowed to do it. So I'm going to keep on letting the ideas, as long as they let me do it, as long as there's an audience for it, tell me how the idea wants to best be serviced. How does it want to exist in the world, and go from there?
Alan Zweibel is a comedy writer, screenwriter, and playwright. He's the author of Laugh Lines, My Life, Helping Funny People Be Funnier. The audiobook will be out July 21st. Find out more about Alan and his work at WPR.org/beta. Now's the part where I whistle.
She always encouraged me to write, and she always celebrated even the smallest paragraph-long things that I published. She learned how to use a laptop because most of my writing early in my career was online.
Bess Kolb joins us to talk about her love letter memoir to her grandma, Bobby. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, Bess. Grandma, I just finished a book I found. It's the life story of Barbara Otis Bell by Bess Bell Cab. It is a wonderful book. I think you were 8, 9 years old, grade 3. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. I'm going to keep it out and show it to you. Okay, honey. I hope all is well. Bye-bye.
That was the late Bobby Bell, better known as Grandma Bobby, to the author of that wonderful book she's recommending, Bess Bell Kolb. Bess is an Emmy-nominated comedy writer who spent 8 years working on Jimmy Kimmel's late-night television show. She also wrote for the 68th Primetime Emmy Awards ceremony. Now Bess is out with her first book. It's called Nobody Will Tell You This But Me, a true, as told to me, story. In the best-selling memoir, Bess channels the voice of her beloved grandmother, Bobby Bell, in funny and poignant ways, and shares her wisdom with the rest of the world. Bess joined us from her home to tell us the origin story behind her book.
I was tasked with delivering a eulogy at my grandma Bobby's funeral, and I was at a complete loss for words. I didn't know what to write, how to properly eulogize the woman who meant so much to me. And so I decided to just do a riff on one of the voicemails that she left me. And I did that. I did it for my whole family. It killed. They were laughing. Some of them cried. And most of all, they recognized her voice and what I was doing. So I just kept doing that. I kept sort of extrapolating from conversations we had and voicemail she left me. I kept writing as her. And that was a way for me to feel close to her when she was gone.
Yeah, was it difficult to chant her grandma Bobby Bell's voice? Or did it just kind of come naturally to you?
You know, it was one of the easiest writing assignments I've ever had. It really did come naturally to me. She and I spoke so frequently during her life that I felt like I had almost downloaded her into me. I had the 10,000 hours of conversations that I could sort of auto-generate her at a moment's notice.
Yeah. So in the book, you go back three generations by having your grandmother talk about her mother, your great-grandmother. What can you tell us about Bobby's mother and how their relationship shaped Bobby's life?
Well, Bobby's mother, who I never met, she died long before I was born, was a larger-than-life character for me growing up. My grandma would constantly refer to her mother. And in researching her and in interviewing family members, what I pieced together was this woman was nothing short of a hero. She's an immigrant who escaped the shtetl and the Pale of Settlement in Belarus under Tsarist control when she was 12 years old. And she did that by herself, and she did that with nothing. And so this 12-year-old with ultimate chutzpah comes to America, illiterate, not speaking the language, and managed to raise four boys and a daughter in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. And she did it with a lot of grit, and she wasn't an especially affectionate mother. This is a woman who came from suffering, but she sacrificed everything for her children, and she taught my grandmother great lessons that I've certainly internalized, like, if you're having a rotten day, buy yourself an ice cream soda and a new hat. And that was Rose.
What did you learn about the relationship between your mother and your grandma while you were writing your book?
I interviewed my mom a lot for this book. She was sort of on the other end of the dispatch phone when I would need details filled in and fact-checking real just anecdotes from before I existed. And I learned that what I had initially assumed was this sort of black and white difference between my relationship with my grandmother and my mother's relationship with her mother. It was my grandma was a distant bad mother and a close good grandmother. And initially, the project of the book was to explore how love can skip a generation. And that was something that I think a lot of people can relate to, which is grandmothers who weren't necessarily present moms ended up being super attentive, doting grandparents. And what I found was much more complex than that. My grandmother deeply loved my mother, and my mother deeply loved her mother, even though their relationship was fraught and tense and full of rebellion and fights. I found that there were some big moments in my grandma's life with her daughter where she was absolutely a hero. She bailed my mom out of a couple of situations that were in some ways life-ending, and she did that out of love.
Can you give an example of one of those situations?
Sure. There are sort of two big ones that come to mind. My mom was in a terrible secret first marriage, secret to me, that it was something that my grandma let slip on a car ride once. My mom was in this terrible first marriage. It was not going well. The guy was bad in every possible way. And my grandma showed up at my mom's door at their apartment in Riverdale in the middle of the night and drove my mom to the airport to get out of the country to get to her friend in Canada's house. And then she sort of took care of the rest. And she and my grandfather ended up handing the guy a check to walk away forever. And yeah, that was my grandma coming in the clutch for sure. She also was the one who got in the jump seat of an airplane next to the flight attendants and flew through the night to my mom's hospital room in France when she just had an inkling that something wasn't right with her daughter. She was absolutely right. My mom was was convalescent in a hospital with I think it was spinal meningitis that had gone to her brainstem.
Wow.
And was told she would never walk again. My grandma got on a plane even when there were no seats and got to her bedside.
Yeah, and your mother obviously recovered from that, the spinal meningitis or whatever it was thing.
Yeah.
Fortunately, yeah. I think that there's one sentence in your book that really seems to sum up the relationship between you and your grandmother. It's this one. I raised you as my equal so I'd have a friend. Do you think it was this friendship that made your relationship so special?
I think so. I think there's this sort of distance that makes a relationship closer, that she wasn't my mother. She wasn't the person responsible for getting me into my winter jacket, you know, insisting that I eat my broccoli. She was somebody who could just sort of waltz in and have the fun times, a friend. And so with that sort of layer of removal from my everyday life, I felt like she and I just sort of got along without any of the tension that a parent-child relationship might be, you know, might be subjected to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that summed it up.
Yeah. Do you think that, did that ever cause jealousy on the part of your mother? Did your mother ever seem to kind of envy the relationship that her mother and you had?
I don't think so. I think she was so, I think there were parts of my relationship with my grandmother where my mom just sort of rolled her eyes and let us have our fun. You know, my grandma had this kid in a frilly dress going to shows and going to department stores. This was something my mother was not and is not interested in. So, you know, she was glad that my grandma was, you know, created this pet to take around on the town and indulge. But she also, she didn't want that from my grandmother. She was glad that we were both getting it out of our system with each other, I think.
You have this great story about a voicemail that she left you after she read a story in the New York Times. You know which one I'm talking about? Can you share that with us?
Yes, I do. Yeah, that was something that there was always an agenda to what my grandma was leaving a voicemail about. It was never on its face exactly what you thought it was. And I think this one is a pretty good example of that. You can, if you read between the lines or just listen to what she's saying, this is not about a cat. This is about a baby. So voicemail, May 2016.
Yeah, hi, Bessie. It's Grandma. I'm reading the New York Times and I saw an article about cats. Are you sitting down? There's a toxin in their feces. It goes directly into your brain and it's apparently very dangerous. Anyway, they say it's bad for pregnancy. There are women in Brooklyn giving away their cats to shelters, which is very smart. I know you love the thing, but if you're handling owls' excrement and changing the litter box, you're risking all kinds of developmental problems, and who knows what? Your mother says you and Charlie aren't trying to have a baby yet, but you never know how these things go, and you don't want to screw yourself up in advance. Give away the cat. I'll mail you the article. You know what? I'll mail it to the cat.
And she did.
Yeah, she really did. You've got a photo of that. Yeah, that's so Grandma Bobby, isn't it? Yeah. Do you think Grandma Bobby's sense of humor influenced you to create your career as a comedian and comedy writer?
You know, my grandma always considered me a writer, even when that wasn't a way that I was able to pay the bills, when I took jobs as a fact checker or, you know, other jobs at magazines, just to be around writers and to be around writing. And she always encouraged me to write. And she always celebrated even the smallest paragraph-long things that I published. She learned how to use a laptop because most of my writing early in my career was online. And she really encouraged me to do things that women weren't allowed to do. This is something that was a very common theme throughout our life together, She had a daughter who broke a gender barrier, being in the first class of women admitted to her college, and then one of the first women in her psychiatric residencies at Columbia Presbyterian. She raised a feminist groundbreaking daughter, and then she saw this granddaughter who was about to relegate herself to a life of checking facts for mostly men's words and men's stories, and she just sort of said to me, "What would a man do?" And she said that to me after I expressed interest in being a comedy writer and living a different life. And so I had the gumption to do what I did and enter a man's world, enter a writer's room where there were only two other women out of 13 or 14 writers. And that was it, with my grandma's wind in my sails, for lack of a better metaphor. That really was with her sort of arms crossed, nodding her head, knowing, yes, this is exactly what you should be doing if it's what you want.
Mm-hmm. And what did she think of your work?
Oh, she loved it. She was so proud of it. She would stay up to watch. I wrote for Jimmy Kimmel Live for 8 years. She would stay up till 11:35 to watch the show. Even when I didn't have a sketch on it, she would try to pick out which were my jokes. She would often call and correctly identify which were my jokes in the monologue.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a particular piece of comedy that you have created that really shows Grandma Bobby's influence?
She shaped this book, and the book is her and in her voice. And it's also me being a comedy writer to the best of my ability. So, you know, what's so special about this is that this is something that I own. It's my voice. It's my name on it, which is something that I just haven't had for 8 years as the sort of behind-the-scenes person, gratefully and with great joy. But this is my grandma as my muse, as my comedy muse.
Grandma Bobby died in 2017. She was 90 years old. How did you find out she died?
I found out when I was in the car alone. I got a phone call from my mother, and it was a surreal and horrible moment. It was not an expected moment. She wasn't extremely sick, and I would talk frequently about her wanting to be there to meet my child, her wanting to be there to give my child hell, and that's not something she was ever able to do. And in that moment, that's what I was thinking of. I was thinking, not yet.
What is the most important life lesson that she taught you?
Most important life lesson is, if you're in a dressing room and you have to think about whether or not it looks good, it doesn't look good. I have a two-part answer to that.
Okay, yeah.
Life lessons.
Second part.
There's that one, and the second part is exactly what I think about now, which is, when the earth is cracking behind your feet and you feel like the world is going to swallow you up, you put one foot in front of the other and you keep going forward. And that is those two life lessons. I don't know which one is more important. Are really indelible in my brain and my heart.
That's a good lesson to learn. Yeah. What do you think Grandma Bobby would think of your book?
I think she would be glad that she has this megaphone now. I think, you know, my grandma loved to tell stories, and I think she'd be really heartened by the fact that everyone who's read the book now knows her stories. So I think she'd be glad that she got the last word. And yeah. I think she'd want to know who's going to play her in the movie.
Yeah. Any ideas?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay. Great. Looking forward to both of those. Best call. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was such a pleasure.
Bess Kolb is a comedy writer and the author of Nobody Will Tell You This But Me, a true as told to me story. Make sure you keep a lookout to see who does land the role of Grandma Bobby in Elizabeth Tromko's upcoming film adaptation. You can find out more about Bess at wpr.org/beta.
He's a pinnacle of, like, what happens when a Midwestern kid who's keenly intelligent and curious about the world and exploratory, what can happen when all of those things kind of come together and you're given a shot.
Author Aaron Osman introduces us to the life and music of Midwestern singer-songwriter Jason Molina. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Singer-songwriter Jason Molina was born in the Rust Belt in 1973. He was a visionary and prolific artist who built a faithful and solid indie following as the frontman for Songs Ohia and Magnolia Electric Company. With shades of Neil Young in his voice and a poet's ear for lyrics, Molina's minimalist style made fans out of his contemporaries, including Ireland's Glenn Hansard. Unfortunately, Jason died in March 2013 of organ failure related to alcohol abuse. He was only 39. Aaron Osman is the author of the definitive biography about the singer, Jason Molina, Riding with the Ghost. Beta's Steve Gotcher zoomed in with Aaron as she shared the story of Jason's life and music and his Midwest roots.
So I think Jason is a really important figure to the fabric of the arts in the Midwest. Jason grew up in Lorain, Ohio, which is a small city on the banks of Lake Erie in northern Ohio. And he grew up in a trailer park, essentially, but it's not maybe what you might typically think. It was really kind of pastoral and beautiful landscape. And he lived with his brother and sister, and they grew up fishing and exploring the woods and, you know, reading a lot. They didn't watch cable television or anything like that. All of his ideas were born of this imagination that was fostered in this sort of remote area where he grew up. And I really relate to that, having grown up in southern Indiana, sort of 2 hours away from any major city. And it was kind of the same thing. I didn't have a lot of access to record stores. I couldn't just walk in and buy any CD that I wanted. It was sort of like a pursuit. And I think that's the story of a lot of kids that grew up in the Midwest, kind of away from major cities, away from the coast. You kind of have to build your own scene and create your own ideas and make your own art. And it's a really DIY pursuit. And I think Jason is really just a paragon of that. He's a pinnacle of like what happens when a Midwestern kid who's keenly intelligent and curious about the world and exploratory, what can happen when all of those things kind of come together and are given a shot.
You also wrote that he found his footing in the progressive campus of Oberlin College. How did Jason's time at Oberlin shape his worldview and the kind of songs that he wanted to write and perform?
Jason's time at Oberlin was really transformative. Before Oberlin, Jason was playing in kind of a wild punk slash alternative band with some guys from high school. But when he went to Oberlin, he sort of transformed into this guy with a guitar and became more of a folk singer.
I tell all your friends that you're bound for glory. How long do you know that you'd make it there before me? What is it like? Is it worth this misfortune?
He met like-minded people both on and off campus there who were supportive of his new idea about who he was as an artist. So he met a lot of other art majors like him. He met some music majors, a couple of townies who played music, and they were really supportive of his kind of poetic outlook and his minimal instrumentation. And I think that really fostered and created the first iteration of the project he called Songs Ohia. And he made lifelong friends that supported him throughout the rest of his life.
Right. Will Oldham of Bonnie Prince Billy fame had a hand in helping Molina with his recording career. What can you tell me about that?
Some of his friends there were big fans of Pals Brothers, which is one of Will Oldham's early groups. And they were going to see a Pals Brothers show in Cleveland. And Jason wasn't old enough to go yet. He wasn't 21. But his friends were kind of like, hey, you should give us a tape to pass to Will. Like, we really think he would like your songs. And so his friend Tom Colley ended up passing a demo to Oldham. And then Oldham got in touch. He wrote Jason a letter explaining that he would love to issue some of the songs. He was running an imprint of Drag City, which is an iconic indie label in Chicago. And so he issued Jason's first single through his imprint on Drag City and was highly influential. Now, that resulted in sort of lifelong comparisons between the two artists. And I think at a certain point, Jason sort of began to resent that or kind of He just wanted that to go away. But Will was really important to the genesis of Jason's career.
Now, the record label Secretly Canadian figures prominently into Jason's story. How are they significant?
Secretly Canadian is a homegrown Bloomington, Indiana-based label, and Jason was their flagship artist. So he was their first big signing. Chris Swanson, who's one of the brothers that co-founded the label, was a huge fan of the Drag City label in Chicago and kind of followed everything that they put out. And when he heard that first 7-inch single by Sons Ohio, he fell in love with it. And he and his brother Ben, who is another co-founder of the label, felt that Jason was a rock star, right? Because he had already issued a 7-inch single and, you know, was it out of the realm of possibility for them to even work with him? But they decided to pursue it. They tracked down Jason's email address, and much to their surprise, he wrote them back immediately. But they tell the story of sort of signing Jason and working with Jason as the first in many tests that Jason would issue them. So in order to do the first single that they did with Molina, he required that they drive to see him play a show in Manhattan, even though he was living right next door in Ohio. So the two brothers packed up their car. They drove, I think, 10 or 11 hours to New York just to get a DAT tape from Jason so they could do the first single. But it created, you know, this really salient memory and this long-lasting relationship because Jason never left Secretly Canadian. He stayed there for the rest of his career.
In 1999, Jason got a fan letter from Irish musician Glenn Hansard, lauding the album known as the Black Album. And you say in your book he explained that the Black Album had become a sort of religious refuge for him, something he enjoyed musically but also craved emotionally, much in the vein of Joni Mitchell's Blue or Five Leaves Left by Nick Drake. What can you tell me about this record?
It has this really timeless quality because the fidelity of the recording is pretty low. It's lo-fi. It was recorded in a house in Oberlin. And oftentimes Jason was like singing in a bathroom with his guitar. So it has a lot of Jason's oblique poetry sung over acoustic guitar, and that's it. There's minimal instrumentation by some of his friends at Oberlin. But yeah, it's just one of those records that came out at the right place and time. I think it affected deeply the people that were able to find it. The cover was really beautiful and mysterious. It's just black and it has a screen print image of a hare on the front. And I think, you know, Glenn had the same experience that many of us did, where we heard this record. It was really unique, it was really touching, it was really haunting and mysterious because it was hard to kind of figure out who Jason was.
It seems that the older inhabitors never got out of you. They phantom brutes were wronged in body. They will make their soon escape by building a new inheritance. It's likely more not to be.
But yeah, Jason and Glenn, who is a rock star in Ireland, became friends and they wrote letters and were friends throughout the rest of Jason's life.
Now, in 2000, Molina released the album The Lioness. The first song is a really haunting lament called The Black Crow. And there's a line in that song that goes,
through sparrow, black wind, a dead to his wings. I'm getting weaker, I'm getting thin, I hate how obvious I have been.
That sounds to me like it's some of the most honest and vulnerable lyrics that there could be. What do you make of this song and this record?
Yeah, that song really socked me in the gut the first time I heard it. And The Lioness is a lot of fans' favorite records for good reason, but it is a darker, moodier record. Jason started playing with electronic or synthesized elements a little bit on this record. It was recorded in Scotland with members of Arab Strap and also Alistair Roberts, who's a Direct City recording artist and a great friend of Jason's. It's also a love record, but it's more mature and it's more, I would say, holistic in terms of like the work that goes into relationships and kind of the heartache that you can feel.
Jason's most successful record was in 2003, the Magnolia Electric Company. What makes this such a standout album?
Magnolia Electric Company is the first time that Jason sort of really went for it. He, for the first time, embodied sort of a maximalist posture as opposed to the more minimalist posture that he had embodied throughout his career up until that point. So he invited a whole host of members of Sons Ohio and guest vocalists and friends to the studio to sort of have this democratic session. He wrote all the songs and sent them to these folks on demos ahead, so they had a little bit of time to rehearse. But there's a lot of elements of live performance in this record, a lot of just great camaraderie and like amalgamation of everything that Jason was up until that point. It all sort of came together, and they're just beautiful, epic, earthen Americana songs on this record that are just so timeless. Farewell Transmission, I've Been Riding with the Ghost, Just Be Simple. I mean, these are all iconic songs of Jason Cannon.
I've been riding with the ghost, I've been doing whatever he told me. I've been looking door to door to see if there was someone who'd hold me.
The record was recorded brilliantly by Steve Albini at Electric Audio in Chicago. Jason's voice was sort of at the top of his game. You know, he was no longer a new singer. He was a very mature, strong, powerful vocalist who could do different things with his voice. Just the range, the depth, and the breadth of writing and playing on this record really coalesced into something truly iconic.
When did it become apparent that he had problems with alcohol, and what do you think the influences were?
Alcoholism ran in Jason's family. His brother struggled with it as well. And, you know, it's just one of those unfortunate things of genetics. His brother would often say that Jason had the kind of alcoholism that kills you, which is, you know, a really difficult thing, I think, to come to terms with. But Jason hid his drinking for a really long time.
Jason's struggle with alcoholism finally led to his death, and on March 16th, 2013, he was found dead in his Indianapolis apartment. How did the music world react to that?
I mean, I think people were really devastated. Jason wasn't an incredibly visible figure, right? He didn't have the following of like Bob Dylan or anything, but the people that knew him and followed his career, and whether that began with Sons Ohio or whether it began with Magnolia Electric Company, Jason built a really loyal fan base. And I think, you know, at a certain point, because he released so many records and because he toured so much, I think the music press sort of forgot him or wrote him off for a little while. There was a point where he just wasn't getting the attention or the coverage that I think he deserved. And so when he died, I think it signaled sort of a shockwave and then a renewed interest in Jason's life and body of work, but then also just a deep sorrow and a deep communing among his worldwide fan base of, you know, folks that had discovered him through independent or sort of underground platforms.
So what is Jason Molina's legacy?
He is really part of the canon of great American songwriters, in my opinion. He belongs in there with Townes Van Zandt and with Neil Young and Dylan and, you know, all the greats. He was never on a major label. He was never playing huge stadiums. But I think his body of work and his point of view and his poetic outlook are deserving of that level of attention, of that level of study, and of that level of celebration.
Erin Osmond, thank you so much for spending some time with me today.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Erin Osmond speaking with Beta's Steve Gotcher about Songs Ohio's Jason Molina. Erin is the author of Jason Molina, Riding with the Ghost. You can find out more about Jason at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Alan Zweibel, Bess Kolb, and Erin Osmond. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I guess it's time to wrap up my involvement in the show.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Oh boy, this guy sure knows how to suck the steam out of a room, doesn't he?
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. Take care and stay safe. I'm Doug Gordon.
Just so you folks at home know, we have somebody cueing the applause. It's the same people I take with me on dates. All right?